Muslim, we have received a lot of questions, and so basically I've placed the priorities on questions that are in relationship to students. And so the first question for you all is that there is talk that the Occupy movement is going to die soon. What advice do you give UC Berkeley students to keep it alive?
Well, one is going to go through different forms and phases. There's no doubt that when the sun comes out in February in California, in April in New York, the Occupy movement will be stronger than ever. Stronger than ever. But it will go through different phases as it moves into the winter. Because tents and snow, well, they go, but they only go for a few folk. I mean, it's not going to be a mass movement out there. Because there are some folk who will stay out there, and I'll be with them in the afternoon. I'll be right there pulling for. But I don't wear coats, so I got to get home when it gets cold like that. But when it come out in April, you're right there again. But the important thing is the idea, the vision, the conviction, the commitment. That will not die with the move into winter.
Okay, well, let me just say this quickly. There is an attempt, a concerted attempt nationwide to slam the door on the Occupy movement.
That's true. That's
both
true.
Through repressing it, these nationally coordinated evictions, and then also trying to co-opt it, to turn it into the tail on the donkey in the electoral arena. And people have to resist that. But here, to me, is what the key is. The key is the resistance to inequality and injustice.
That's right.
And the deeply questioning why things are like this. Because even if you can't get together in Zuccotti Park or wherever it was that people were occupying, you can still resist. You can still dig into those questions. And you have to figure out the ways to do that collectively.
That's right.
And you can continue to connect the dots between the different kinds of injustice and the resistance that's developing. And on that basis, you could come out with a stronger movement,
absolutely,
one that sees more clearly what it's up against and has brought together allies from different experiences, you know, which there's tension in that process, but it's also important to take up.
Okay, thank you. And we are willing to take questions from the mic as well, so we want to go back and forth through the written ones versus a mic question. So we're going to shift to a mic question.
Jeff Brooks, I would like to see a show of hands. Over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of the U.S. occupying the Middle East, and there were millions of people that stood behind bin Laden in wanting to kill Americans. I'm thinking that those may be less likely to attack us because America is getting occupied. So I'm thinking that the Occupy movement is a citizen diplomat movement, that it's avoiding this tension of trying to get revenge on America because now America is occupied. Is that too way out?
I didn't fully follow that, though.
The occupiers are citizen diplomats.
Uh-huh.
The March 16th, 2004 poll of the Middle East, of four Middle Eastern countries, found huge percentages of people that thought justified killing of Americans was a good idea. So where are those 300 million Middle Easterners today?
Okay, I see the point that you're raising. Okay. I guess here's how I look at it. You still got the U.S. firing drones into Pakistan, you know, killing people. They say they're shooting at terrorists, but look, you shoot a drone, it's going to destroy a whole village. You know, so you might hit somebody who was mad at you, but you're going to hit a whole bunch of other folks. And as long as that's going to keep going down, people are going to be righteously angry, and a challenge for people in this country, including people in the Occupy movement, is to go global with this question of the 99%. That there are people all around the world who we relate to, we stand with, And it's going to be on that basis that people should develop around the world a different view towards this country. But then, and see, here's why I say that it'll take nothing less than revolution, because as long as the U.S. is shooting off those drones and sending troops into Africa, they sent troops into Africa about a month or so ago, in addition to the Middle East, there are going to be people who hate being invaded, being bombed and all like that. Mm-hmm. And we have to actually stand up and struggle against that and resist that in this country, in addition to resisting the inequality and injustice here in this country. And like I say, we got to make revolution so that these folks, this ruling class that's firing off these drones to keep their global thing in effect, are no longer in position to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we'll go back to a written question.
Okay.
And this one states, we are taught to be ashamed of our past, of our poverty, ashamed of not being successful. But you, Professor Cornel West, have de-shamed us. Thank you. So the question is, how do we redefine success?
Appreciate the question. One is that, I appreciate the kind words, but no one individual can fully de-shame. That when you look at me, you see the people who love me. You see the people who sacrificed for me, the people who cared for me. I am just one moment in a rich tradition. So all you are getting is just these nuggets of wisdom. I just got nuggets. They had huge rocks in the past because they're dealing with levels of catastrophe of slavery and Jim Crow and Jane Crow and self-hatred and self-violation and self-destruction I couldn't even conceive of. But I still want to be connected with them. And I try to get all the wisdom I can. So if I just drop a nugget, that's not just me. That's my grandmama speaking through me. You see? That's Fannie Lou Hamer speaking through me. That's Huey Newton speaking through me. And it's Curtis Mayfield. But the musician speaking through me. So in that sense, we always want to couch it in a tradition, a rich tradition. Then the question of miseducation. There's a qualitative difference between schooling and education. If all you're going to do is just get schooled, then you're going to end up with a skill with the same empty soul, hollow orientation, and moral backwardness, spiritual malnutrition, and moral constipation. But you'll be very smart. And the worst thing that has happened to young people is we've told young people to be the smartest in the room. Just like that film, The Social Network. You see, just empty. The smartest in the room, Nazis, some of them were very smart. The defenders of American apartheid, some of them were very smart. They had PhDs from Harvard. But you know what? They were gangsters. They were thugs when it came to the humanity of poor and especially people of color. And there's no monopoly of any one group or race in that regard. So when we talk about de-shaming, all we're saying is we want a holistic, deep education that goes beyond schooling so you connect courage, compassion, bearing witness. Now, what my dear brother calls revolution, I call bearing witness. Because I'm a Christian. Because all I'm going to do before I die is bear witness and go to the coffin. Now, that will involve itself with working with revolutionaries and even being critical of revolutionaries. In light of the love, but bearing witness. And bearing witness is a beautiful thing. There's joy in serving others, and never confuse that with pleasure. We live in a society obsessed with pleasure, and education becomes schooling and miseducation when it's just about your own narcissistic pleasure. But joy is something else. Don't get caught in the joyless quest for pleasure. Get some joy in there. So you really have soul, like the soul stirs of Lou Rawls and Sam Cooke, rather than just body stimulators of bubblegum music these days among young folk. But we won't get into that right now.
Yeah. I just want to add a story from my own past on this thing of redefining success and greatness.
Yes, yes.
Because When I was when I got the orders to go to Vietnam, I really felt that morally I should not go, and practically it wouldn't be such a good idea, you know, because, no, I'd be shooting at people, and they'd be shooting at me, and I saw some of those GIs that came back from Vietnam, and they had lost their motherfucking minds. I mean, they were just off. Mm. But the last thing that I had to deal with was I knew my parents wanted me to be successful. Mm. And how could I go to them and say, Mom, Dad, I'm going to jail because I think this is wrong. And even more than that, I think the whole country is wrong. And I think I need to be a revolutionary. And, you know, I thought about that. And I went on leave before it was time to go. And I said, well, I got to tell them. You know, and I told my mother and father, and my mother was worried for my safety. That was always my mother's take.
That's love. That's love. No.
Yes. Yeah, that's but my father's thing was, do you think this is right? Mm. And I said, I know it's right. And then he said, well, if it's right, then you should do it as well as you can.
Ooh, that's beautiful. You know? That's beautiful, man.
If you're going to stand up this way, then don't stand up half-assed, go all the way, and go as far as you can with it. And that's what people need to do today. They need to get to the truth of something and then act on that truth and act as well as they can, taking it as far as they can. And then also be open to new sources of information and analysis, which might let you know that you was off in one sense or another. Because, you know, you can't proceed like you got 100% knowledge. That would be just objectively not true. The only way you can get as deep an understanding of reality is to be open to other viewpoints, including ones that disagree with you.
That's right.
We have a question from this side. Okay. So my question in regards to the talks on the Occupy movement that you've referenced earlier, and it seems to be a very pro-Occupy stance, but I feel like some of the other issues that we have been speaking about tonight, race, gender, the prison industrial complex, homophobia, all of these issues, don't tie in to what I see going on with the Occupy movements and who is out there and who is protesting and what they're standing for. Because from what I see, it's a middle class, white college graduates out there who are upset because there are no jobs. And we see the media paying attention almost as if it was Vietnam again. It's not a problem until it's a middle class problem. And so the power dynamics are still very existent, even within this movement. And we look at film from the Occupy Atlanta, where John Lewis went to speak, and he wasn't allowed to speak, and he was shut down by a white male who had a megaphone and took several votes, and there was a lot of confusion in the crowd. And so we see this power dynamic with race, again, even within the movement. So I'm questioning whether this is a movement of social justice or if it's about white middle class people who can't get a job. And, you know, where were they 6 years ago when middle class income was on the rise by 6%? You know, these are issues that people have been facing since the beginning of time. We look at the Native Americans, we look at Latinos, we look at blacks. You know, these are issues that have been going on. Where were they?
Mm-hmm. No, appreciate the question.
Could I say a word about that?
Go ahead. Right there. My dear sister, I appreciate that question. It's a very important question. We had magnificent discussions here at Occupy Oakland just a few weeks ago on precisely that issue. But I think, one, we have to be very careful where we get our information from. You see, if you're looking at CNN as opposed to Amy Goodman, you're going to get a very different perspective of who's there. You know what I mean? Or MSNBC or Fox News and so forth. The corporate media tends to be truncated in its representations of the variety and diversity of the Occupy movements. There's a whole lot of different folk out there, large numbers. I mean, a number of them, precious homeless brothers and sisters, right there with them. You you see. Now, you are right, it's disproportionately young, it's disproportionately vanilla, and 43% of them have been through college a year or two or three. So it's tilted in that way. But you see, when you talk about truth and justice, if it's true and it's just, no matter who says it, it's the issue. You see what I mean? So if they're talking about corporate greed, and corporate greed is pushing the nation to the brink of catastrophe, whoever says it, it's true. You see what I mean? It's true. So that in that sense, you certainly have students concerned about their loans and so on, but that's just one element. One element. You got anarchists out there who've been organized since Seattle 12 years ago. You got communists out there. You got Democratic Socialists of America, my own. You got a whole lot of folk. You got some Christian evangelicals out there. We got Union Theological Seminary, where I'm headed. I just left Princeton, you all know. I'm going back to Union Theological Seminary in New York. We got a Union Theological Seminary occupied chaplaincy of 45 pastors. And they're not there for student loans. You see what I mean? So that I hear what you're saying, the movement must deal with these issues. Of course, it's going to be racism in the Occupy movement. This is America. What you expect? All white folk ain't not going to become John Brown overnight. That's not going to happen. It's not going to become Miles Horton overnight. But if they're trying to fight against racism, you got to help them fight against racism. Come together. Let's fight against this patriarchy. Let's fight against homophobia. Make sure our Jewish brothers and sisters feel open if they're willing to be critical about the state of Israel vis-a-vis the occupation. See what I mean? That's very important. Palestinians, they've got to keep track of the humanity of the Jewish brothers and sisters, and they join too. Because if we're talking about love, justice, and so forth, it's a higher standard for all of us. All of us will fall short. Each and every one of us will fall short, but we know what the standards will be. And that's where we learned for the best of what Martin was talking about in the 60s. He said, we need Martin King so bad, and if we could just put a smile on his face from the grave, ooh, that would be a major thing. Because he'd been weeping for 30-some years, every day, every day. Even with black presidents, he's still crying. He is, because
yeah.
He loves the symbolism. But when he looks on the ground and sees the precious human beings dealing with deplorable conditions and circumstances, he's on the love train. He's got that love supreme. He weeps. We got to put a smile on that brother's face. But he is just a moment in a tradition that goes all the way back, down through the corridors of time.
Yeah,
that was a long answer to that question. I appreciate that question, though, sister.
Let me hit this a little shorter, I hope. Mm-hmm. 6 years ago, most of the people in the Occupy movement were sleepwalking past the graveyard and everything that was going on around them because things seemed to be going well. Frankly, 3 years ago, a lot of them were swept up into Obama mania. Okay? But at this point, they're opening their eyes to something. They're standing up against some injustice. And my approach to that is, I'm not going to be mad at you because you wasn't there 6 years ago or 3 years ago. I'm going to go to you right now and say you're on to something, but you're not seeing the whole picture. Here is what it looks like. I'm going to go to you with what's happening around the world, that this 99% has to be seen on a global level. I'm going to go to you with what's happening up in Harlem, what's happening over in Bed-Stuy or in the South Bronx. This is going down every day. And if you want to talk about the 99%, you got to say that this section of it over here in the ghettos and barrios are dealing with some things. And if you see that as outside of your issues, you're not relating to the 99%. I'm going to challenge people to not only be true to their principles, but to take those principles and on that basis, dig deeper into reality. I'm going to challenge them to engage this thing of what I have to say about nothing short of revolution can deal with all of this, and then get into all of the political and ideological questions that come up around that. You know, can we organize horizontally? Can we organize at a distance from the state? Well, you tried that at Zuccotti Park, and the state came down and sprayed pepper spray in your face, you know. you can't organize at a distance from the state, especially if you're going to look at everything that's going on. You know, the Pakistanis who've been hit with these drone attacks, they weren't trying to get up close to the state. The American global state intruded into their lives, and we have to actually end that. So I'm going to take that to people. And like I say, I'm not going to be mad at them about where they were 6 years ago or even last year. I'm going to be like, here's where you need to be looking now. Here's where you need to be going. Here are some principles, and you need to act on them. You know, and I think that's the approach that needs to be taken on this.
And as we take questions from the mic, I want to encourage everyone to be very concise in your question. That is, it's not necessary to give a lot of context. Just ask the question. And with that said, I'm going to ask the next question, which is, okay, as a student, it's hard to find a balance between social justice issues and maintaining scholarly duties. So what are some of your tips for student activists who want to graduate? I added the graduation part.
Our dear brother told us he's spending good time in the library. That was a very important lesson, I thought, that you're here to exercise a love of wisdom and a love of learning and a love of knowledge. You won't stop there, but that's one of the forms of love that you ought to take seriously. So if you want to be a full-time activist, then become a full-time activist. But if you want to be a student who is activist, who in the long run wants to be able to not only follow your own heart, because you're here to find your voice. You don't ask anybody's permission as to what you're on the earth for. You might ask for your mama's consultation, but not her permission. So you gotta decide, what are you here? What is your vocation, not just your profession? What is your calling, not just your career? Don't tell me about your job, I wanna know about your life task. And once you decide that, you go into the laboratory. I'm going to be a scientist. I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to be a poet. I'm going to be a musician. I'm going to be a pharmacist. And then find time within your vocation for your activism. You see? Now, if your calling is to be a full-time activist, like this brother right here, it's a beautiful thing. You see? But as we said, imitation is suicide. Everybody can't be a full-time activist. Is that right, though, brother?
Not everybody, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I know. I couldn't do it. I got other things. I got to do. So I got to get to the studio, get to the library, the laboratory, hit the church and the club. Hey, I got one life. One life to live. All in the name of Jesus, too, goddamn.
Okay. I may not be the best one to ask that question because I never graduated. But there was actually a story to that. I got drafted about halfway through. And then by the time I got out, I could have gone back and gotten some funding to do that, because even though they convicted me and sent me to jail, they tossed the conviction out after I had done the time. But at that point, changing the world was my vocation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, but I do value what I studied before I came out, and this might surprise some people, because I was an engineering student who mainly studied mathematics. But one thing that I think I was able to draw from that is a certain scientific approach and trying to draw from reality, which I've tried to use in terms of going at the question of social justice. And see, what I would say to people is, you do have to decide what is it that you are moved to do. And you got to do that based upon understanding reality and why it's the way that it is, and also what could be done about it. And if that moves you to do like I did and pass on the opportunity to graduate and throw into, you know, changing the world, then go do that. And like I said earlier, do that as well as you can. But if you're trying to balance the two, then go ahead and balance the two. What I would say to you, though, is do not allow the graduation and career to blunt you on this question of the truth and acting on that truth. Mm-hmm. You know, because if that's part of what it's required to obtain a career, then that's a bargain you don't want to make. That's like a deal with, and I'll say it, a deal with the devil.
Oh yeah, Faustian, Mephistopheles, and
I knew you would get literary about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we're gonna bring Gerda in on this thing, absolutely.
We have a next question on this side, a very concise question.
Concise. My question is, may I or can someone give you this thank you gift that I have for you here?
Oh, we can grab it right now.
That's what I'm talking about. Basically, this is it's a music project where there's interviews and conversations with people like Michelle Alexander when she was on Democracy Now, and Naomi Klein, and Noam Chomsky, and it's all set to music.
It's heavy stuff.
That's right, and you are on that project. No, you and Carl Dix are on that project. No, y'all,
did you
conversation that you all had in Harlem.
Did you bring two?
Yeah, I got one of my people's got it back there. I'll get you there. But the conversation that you all had in Harlem in 2009, the Obama ascendancy, that conversation is on there, set to some dope music.
Dang, that's nice.
Okay. Thank you.
That's nice, appreciate that.
The next question is, as a 10-year-old, what can I do to help the revolution?
Okay, well, it's never too early to start. And again, this thing is, because there is injustice out there. You don't have to be, there's no minimum age to recognize that injustice and to reach out to others and help to involve them. And that youthful energy that 10-year-old has got can be put to working at things. It can help reach out to others. I talked about this thing about mass incarceration. I don't know what your skills are, but there may be ways in which you could do some drawings to help dramatize that from a very youthful perspective. You know, posing this thing of family members disappearing. Why are they disappearing? Why is it always happening to certain kinds of people? You can pose a lot of questions that would have broader parts of society, including older folks, like, wow, you know, a 10-year-old is getting this. There's a way in which this could have big impact. So I would say, get at that injustice that you see in society. Dig as deep as you can to figure out why it's like that. And then look for others, and including getting some other 10-year-olds in it. Because, no, I mean, that was an important thing. Like, back in the day, there were the Panther Cubs and different things like that, youth organizations that were active. An active part of the revolutionary movement, and I think that would be important.
That's a very profound question. I got an 11-year-old daughter myself, and we have deep dialogue. She raises questions that I oftentimes cannot answer. And I tell her when she asks me a question like that, I say, honey, I want you to continue to learn how to love. Learn how to receive love, because there will be no revolution of any quality unless we have high capacity to love others and have a hypersensitivity to the pain of others. They don't need to look like you. They don't need to live in your hood or your neighborhood, but try somehow to have some deep bond and connection to other people's suffering so that it has weight in your life. And you can get that from reading the Toni Morrison children's book with Slade. You can get that from music. You can get that from learning how to love your mother and father better and listening to your grandparents. You can learn about accenting the right text in your synagogue, a temple, a church, or trade union. But we live in a society where there is a systematic attempt to marginalize, if not render impotent, generosity, compassion, love, and service to others. You can almost ask the psychologist. You get a 10-year-old who has a hypersensitivity to the pain of others, they're abnormal. Because we're producing narcissists. We're producing hedonists. That's what they get on television every day. So somebody loving everybody, something must be wrong with them. No, the society has a sickness. It's not the young folk who's trying to love have a sickness, you see. And of course, they can't do that on their own. They've got to do that in a connected way. So that's not an answer, that's an attempt, a gesture at an answer. But that's something that I would push to that 10. Is a 10-year-old here who asked that question? Where? Oh, give her a hand, give her sister a hand. Our dear sister, raising that profound question like that. Oh, from the mouths of babes at UC Berkeley, shall we learn?
Indeed. We want to remind you to fill out the questionnaire that was on your seat in your program. We really, really need the questionnaires. And as you submit your questionnaire, we also want to encourage you to donate if you have not, in terms of supporting our efforts for this program. So now we're going to have a concise question on this end.
Well, first off, I want to say thank you for giving us instructions to a better society. We really appreciate that. But my question is, the theme of the night has been focused around youth and education and also revolutionary activism. I know you spoke about being a jazz listener. Me, myself, I'm a hip-hop listener.
Yeah.
And I was listening to an artist called Kendrick Lamar, and he said he tagged himself as a revolutionary and said his faith is inevitable, talking about basically when the 1% sees that a revolutionary is there, their mission is to knock him down before his message gets out. My question to you two is, why aren't we, as a community, building schools and elementary schools and high schools and keeping our youth in there and instilling methodologies and the real truth? Because we say that we don't learn the real truth. Why don't we have educators and people that know the real truth and are willing to spread that seed and in schools and kind of keeping schools together and then pumping our kids out to the Ivy Leagues and things of that nature? So why aren't we on that track? And is there any initiatives that like people like us college goers, I go to San Jose State, that we can do. Yeah, definitely. So is there any type of initiatives that we can do that, to kind of get that ball rolling?
You want to say a word on that though, bro?
Well, I can start on it.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that everybody can do, and this is important for college students, is that they can reach to younger youth. And you don't have to have a school to do that. You could actually figure out how to connect with some high school students and take to them some of what you've learned, and not just what you've learned in college, but what you appear to have learned living life. You know, you could bring to them some of what they're not getting in terms of what where the situation they're up against comes from and how they can begin to deal with it. And out of those discussions, this can spread, because I remember back when I was young, if folks from college, you know, came to talk with us about stuff, we wanted to hear that, because we knew that they had gone through this before us, and they were coming back with some knowledge, you know, and we wanted to grapple with that. And that was actually an important role that college students who started getting into the revolutionary movement played, by bringing stuff back to the younger youth who were in high school and like that. And they seeded us with some ideas about, and some challenges, because when we saw them doing things like, you know, getting with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, getting involved in that, doing the sit-ins, opposing the war in Vietnam, then it was kind of like, damn, could we do that? I think we could.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of spurred some of us. And I know my brother, he did his first action when I got sent to jail for refusing to go to Vietnam. He organized students there, not directly in relation to my case, but He said, I got to do something too. My brother is doing that. I got to do something too. So they did a walkout at his high school. You know, so I would say that in relation to that, that there are definitely steps that could be taken, including right now, to reach back to other youth, not only organizing at your college, but reaching back to other youth in the community and in the high schools.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing is always keep in mind, there's always people who care. It's just that oftentimes they don't have power resources to be visible. So we had to hunt them out. People like Marion Wright Edelman has freedom schools across the country. Hmm. She doesn't have the money that these charter schools have. But she's got freedom schools. We need more young people part of those kinds of schools. Same is true, as you say, with our musicians. You see. I mean, your brother Jay-Z, lyrical genius. Kanye West, near genius. Both of them on the throne right now, right? Now, they were more influenced by Immortal Technique. It creates a different atmosphere. See what I mean? I want them to be themselves. I don't want them to be Immortal Technique. But if they are influenced by all of that attention, all of that influence, all of that visibility, all of that publicity and celebrity would be put to use to something grander than the little narrow effects that it has when it comes to justice, when it comes to courage. You see what I mean? That's why when I talk with Eric about doing the others, we're talking about courageous artists who affect young people who, when you listen to their great artistry, they also speak to your soul and generate the kind of courage that's required. That's what we had in the 60s. That's what young folk do not have today. You see, if I were growing up right now, I would be more, there was a brother named Rudy Ray Moore when I was growing up. He talked about Dolemite.
Yeah.
And I love Rudy Ray Moore, don't get me wrong, but if he was a dominant face of black culture rather than Gil Scott-Heron or Curtis Mayfield or Aretha Franklin, I would have been a very different kind of person. Because what he was talking about was that thin stuff. You know what I mean? Orgiastic foreplay. You know. That thin stuff, body stimulation, sexual conquest, that's what the brother was talking about. Now, he got a right to do that. That's fine. It's not the most spiritually healthy way of being in the world, but that's fine. But that's what young people are bombarded with every minute of the day. And you say, well, what happens to the deeper hip-hop artists? Well, you got to go see them Friday night at the Poetry Jam. You got to go underground because they can't get a deal. They're not visible because the recording industry and the radio industry and the video industry wants to keep that bubblegum stuff visible so that people won't wake up. So it's a matter of priorities. It's priorities in that regard. So I'm with you. And keep listening to that good hip-hop. Because we hip-hop was one of the great cultural breakthroughs of the last 45 years. But we've gone from KRS-One to Chuck D to where we are now. But oh yeah, we coming back though. Oh yeah, this is what we're talking about tonight. We coming back. We bouncing back. Oh yes, my friend, absolutely. Indeed. It's so good to see you though, man.
Time is not on our side, so we're gonna only have time for one question from each side, and then we're gonna put closure. So the next person with the mic. Concise question, please.
Sure. So I don't know if you know, but in this room in 2010, there was a debate about divesting this university's funds from Israel for its occupation and the racism against Palestinians.
Mm.
And I appreciate a lot of the remarks tonight and also including the ones on Palestine. And I'm wondering a question about tactics, though. You know, a lot of people like, you know, say it's wrong, the occupation, but they were like, divestment, nah, you know, we don't want to touch that. It was okay in the South African case in the 80s or whatnot, but you know, now we're not so sure. And so I'm wondering if you personally would support divestment, and if not, you know, what distinguishes the divestment efforts against Israeli racism from South African racism? And if so, what lessons can be learned, especially on university campuses and from the 80s efforts to fight apartheid with boycott and divestment?
Okay.
You want to say something?
All right, well, what I would say is I would support an effort at divestment from Israel. One thing, though, that you have to remember about the South African divestment is that the movement around that started well before it was successful. You know, because the African Liberation Day Coordinating Committee started in 1972. I happened to have been at the founding conference where they did that. That's why I know when it was formed. and it was really in the 80s that it took hold. So some people had to work at that for about a decade to bring it out. And what was very important in relation to that was the exposure of exactly what was happening to people in South Africa and the connections between the United States and all that going down. And it was through that that a movement was brought forward where there were young people in this country who felt like they had to take a stand on it. But there was at least a decade that went on before it really took hold. And you have to see, you got to work with that. You know, you actually have to bring out to people, here's the reality. You got to understand that you're going to be going up against, you know, some stuff, because they're not going to get this in the media, the mainstream media. They're not going to get this more broadly in society. So you have to figure out how to bring it out in ways that it touches people and moves them to want to act.
Well, one, I would just want to salute you, though, brother, for even being part of such a movement. To talk about Israeli-Palestinian issues in America is one of the most difficult and delicate things you can do. And it takes courage to do that, but we have to do it. There's no doubt that U.S. foreign policy has been predicated on the notion that a Palestinian life does not have the same value as an Israeli life. That's wrong. That's wrong. Jewish lives are precious, Palestinian lives are precious, they all are human. They have the same value, same status, same dignity, same sanctity, I say, as a Christian. The question then becomes, then how does one proceed in such a way that you make very clear these are universal principles so people don't think that somehow you're just highlighting the state of Israel, given the long history of anti-Jewish hatred that we know has been shot through the makings of the modern world and Christianity and a whole host of other religious formations, you see. So that, for example, if you say the end of the, this would be my view, the end is, or the aim is, the end of occupation. Any occupation of any people, you see. If Palestinians were dominating Jews, it's immoral, it's wrong, it's unjust. And you say the aim is the end of occupation, per se. And we're going to do all we can to end that occupation. You see, making it clear with the universal principles, then I think we've got to, we begin to muster a very strong case for divestment and so on. But it's a very treacherous terrain, as you can imagine. And one has to be very, very clear about the universal of it, the universalism of the principles on the one hand, and at the same time, just how difficult it is in light of the history of anti-Jewish hatred and what is so easily accepted in this country, which is not valuing the lives of Palestinians the way we value other lives, especially in America.
And our last question.
Earlier was said something about what can we do to awaken our brothers and sisters who are still sleepwalking. And so I would like to ask, what would you say to those like people of color or anyone who is hesitant to fully engage in the Occupy movement?
Oh, well, one, my dear brother, I appreciate the question, that participation in the Occupy movement is not the only criteria of people who are awake. See? I mean, the Occupy movement is a beautiful thing, but it has no monopoly on the struggle for justice. It has no monopoly on the struggle for freedom and so forth. There's a lot of other contexts where you can do magnificent things and just, if you're religious, say prayers for the Occupy folk. I'm praying for you. I got other things I'm doing. So you know what I mean? We're dealing with domestic violence over here. We got cowardly brothers of all colors who's dealing with abuse and violence of women. This is going to be my context. Occupation movement, I know you all are concerned. You're not making it a priority. So I'll see you once every 2 weeks, but I'm focusing on this issue. That's beautiful. See, the movement is like a jazz orchestra, man. We're just lifting all these voices, but everybody can't be in Duke Ellington's band. Count got a band, too. And Fletcher Henderson got a band. And the Natural Four got a group. And the Whispers got a group. Everybody can't sing in the same group. You see what I mean? So the Occupy movement can't just suck the air out of the whole room just because they're visible. They're just doing magnificent things, and some of us spending a lot of time, but there's a lot of different other contexts. You see what I mean? But we should always note, and this is a point that my dear brother Raymond Ross reminds me, that people wake up at different times. Brother Carl Dix made the same point. People wake up at different times, right? Malcolm Little, it took him a while to wake up, didn't it? But Lord, when that Negro woke up and became a free black man, he woke up. All of us. Is that right, Brother Imam? You remember the time when you hadn't woke up? And boy, you fully alert now. That's a beautiful thing. So it's a process. You know what I mean? Lil Wayne might end up being on the cutting edge of struggle for justice. Give him time, tattoos and all. Give that brother time. You don't know. 50 Cent might be on the cutting edge. You just don't know. You gotta love him no matter what.
Okay, we want to, first of all, show our speakers extra love for all of their energy and effort.
And Professor Taylor, we love you, Professor Taylor, Eula Taylor, Professor Clark, the late Barbara Christian, the late Professor Barbara Christian. We'll never forget you, Barbara Christian, never, never. How you doing, my brother?
Brother Carl Dix has dared us to hope, and Brother Cornell West has encouraged us to understand that justice is what love looks like. On behalf of the Department of African American Studies and a host of other people, thank you for coming out tonight.